Good morning. It is 7:49 and you are listening to Raven Radio. Today is Thursday, August 23rd, 2012. I'm Holly Keene and this is Raven News. Petersburg wants to become a borough. During a teleconference Wednesday, the state said okay, and now it's up to area voters. Alaska's Local Boundary Commission approved its written decision on the matter. Commission staffers Brent Williams said he expected to put the document in the mail by the next day.
That the mail out will start the reconsideration period, which is 18 days for the public from the date of mailing, and it is 30 days for the commission. That information is in the decision, and as a courtesy, the parties will also email it to them so they get it as quickly as possible.
There were no comments on the final decision, either from the commission or the handful of supporters and opponents who were listening online. However, one borough opponent, George Cole, said he had prepared a request for reconsideration. Wednesday's teleconference was somewhat of a formality since the five-member commission had actually made its decision in Petersburg at the beginning of June after several days of extensive public testimony and debate. Petersburg proposed borough government would expand municipal boundaries and taxing authority over a much larger area. The new borough would include the cities of Petersburg and Kuprianov, as well as Midikoff and Wodewaski Islands, a large portion of Kuprianov Island, and the mainland from Lakanti Bay to Holcomb Bay. The city and borough of Juneau filed a competing petition seeking to annex some of the same mainland territory. Juneau's annexation petition is still before the LBC. Staff reports on that are due out this fall and winter, and the commission would vote on the Juneau petition in January. Once the LBC mails out its written decision, it's up to the state's Division of Elections to arrange a public mail-in vote for residents in the proposed borough boundaries. The division has a month to set a date of the election, which must be held between 30 and 90 days after it's announced. That means the election will take place sometime in the late fall or winter, unless the Boundary Commission decides to reconsider within the next 30 days. A commercial fishing safety program that's been a huge success in Alaska is turning its focus to commercial fleets in the Gulf of Mexico and the East Coast. But expanding requires money, and as KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, NIOSH may not have much of that in the future.
When NIOSH started investigating injuries to Alaskan seiners a few years ago, they found a common theme. Researchers were able to trace countless instances of crushing, amputation, and drowning, all back to getting tangled up in the net.
They get caught up and wrapped, and once they get wrapped, they can't reach the controls to shut down the winch.
That's Chelsea Woodward, one of four researchers on NIOSH's commercial fishing safety team. Woodward is the engineer. It was his job to design a simple tool based on NIOSH's SANER research. He came up with a design for an emergency kill switch that would quickly stop the net from winding up. The fishermen who tested the kill switch on their SANE boats liked it, and that kill switch is now sold commercially in a kit. Woodward says Alaska fishermen are ideal research subjects. They're willing to collaborate and provide input on NIOSH's research and gear designs.
This is a good place because of the understanding the commercial fishermen have with NIOSH. There's a better understanding that NIOSH is not regulatory. We have their best interest in mind.
But Woodward says fishermen outside Alaska don't always understand that NIOSH is a research agency. It doesn't deal in law enforcement, and it's totally separate from OSHA, which can hand out fines for safety violations. That's just one reason why NIOSH may face an uphill battle as it embarks on an eastbound safety campaign. NIOSH wants to start sharing its research on commercial fishing safety in Alaska with fishermen in the Gulf of Mexico and the Atlantic Ocean. Eventually, Woodward says he'd like to see his safety tools on those vessels, too.
We can take the solutions that have been developed jointly with commercial fishermen in Alaska and see if they're a good fit for the East Coast scallopers or draggers.
But the commercial fishing safety team is already stretched thin. Bob Kehoe is the executive director of the Purse Seine Vessel Owners Association in Seattle. Kehoe worked with NIOSH researchers a few years back when he invited them to give a presentation at one of his conferences.
That is a struggle for them. You know, they try to do with a limited budget to go out and travel and get to know groups and fishermen themselves, but that takes time, and you know you can only reach so many people.
NIOSH is committed to its Alaska fishing research, and they'll keep that up even as they start expanding to the Gulf and East Coast this fall. They may hire a few temporary assistants to help out, but Kehoe is right. The NIOSH team's time is at a premium, and so is money. NIOSH's budget has been threatened several times over the years, and it's happening again. The White House has released a proposed 2013 budget that cuts all money for NIOSH research on commercial fishing, forestry, and agriculture. Woodward says his agency is taking this threat seriously. But for now, the federal budget still isn't finalized. And until NIOSH knows exactly how much money they have to work with, they're pushing forward.
We'll work as hard as diligent as we can to continue. And because good things are coming from it, we have to have the faith that the powers that be will recognize that and the rest of it will fall into place.
And maybe if they can show fishermen and the federal government that there's more work to be done, these researchers will make it through another year. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
The first forest reserve in Southeast Alaska turned 110 years old this week. At the time, the area was 4.5 million acres of virgin spruce, hemlock, and cedar. Within a few years, it tripled in size and was renamed the Tongass National Forest. It's now the largest national forest in the United States. As KTOO's Matt Miller tells us in this Encore report, the man who proposed creating the Forest Service was better known for his efforts to preserve Tlingit artifacts.
So you get to sign in here,
okay,
and just check, research.
The basement of the Alaska State Museum is the most protected part of the building. Here are some of Alaska's most treasured relics. Several rows of metal storage cabinets are filled with bentwood boxes, basketry, and other native artifacts. Curator of collections Steve Henriksen brings out a spruce root basket hat, estimated at more than 100 years old.
This hat is done exactly like hats are being made today with the twining technique. Part of the design is made by a raised part of the weaving, which is called a skip stitch technique. That's this raised pattern on the edge, but then over the top of that there's a painted crest design, and anytime you see a painted hat, that represents a collaboration between a woman who wove the hat and a man who painted the hat.
There are traditional Tlingit and Haida designs painted in red, green, and black on top of the hat, interspersed with some rather curious markings resembling a tic-tac-toe grid.
This particular hat, just because of the way the painting is, I would have a tendency to think it was something made for the market, but it is very, very similar to hats that were used by the native people themselves for ceremonies.
The hat was acquired by Naval Lieutenant George Thornton Emmons. Emmons was assigned to a gunboat patrolling the Federal District of Alaska in 1882, just 15 years after his father, Captain George Foster Emmons, took part in ceremonies transferring ownership of Alaska from Russia to the United States. The younger Emmons and his Navy colleagues were essentially the only local police force.
They did everything from guarding the coastline from foreign governments doing things against the wishes of the United States, but they also dealt with petty theft and dog problems and were active in health issues, treating Alaska Natives for various diseases. They conducted courts.
While on patrol, Emmons developed a passion for Tlingit culture, which he feared was disappearing. He even tried to learn the language. Emmons collected thousands of artifacts. Some, like the basket hat, appeared to be manufactured for tourists of the day. But Emmons acquired other objects by digging through the graves of shamans, sometimes assisted by Tlingits. Historian David Conrad, author of two articles on Emmons, believes that generated plenty of hard feelings.
See, he was selling this stuff to the big museums. And there's more Tlingit and Haida art in the Field Museum in Chicago than there is in Alaska because of him. And they resent that, the art people that.
Museums in New York, Washington, and Chicago eagerly purchased Emmons artifacts, not only because of the quality, but also because he took great pains to document each item. Henriksen says even the predecessor of the State Museum purchased its first Emmons collection in 1911.
There's good reason to believe that the collecting of certain objects helped further the demise of the culture they were trying to save, in a way, because by taking art, important ceremonial and sacred objects away from the native people, that made it harder to perpetuate the culture that the artifacts symbolize.
On the other hand, Henriksen notes, had Emmons not intervened at all, then many of the objects probably would not have survived the last century. Some artifacts are now returning home, like a 3-foot carved beaver canoe prow that Emmons acquired in Angoon. It was repatriated from the American Museum of Natural History in New York just 3 years ago. The prow now rests in a metal cabinet in the basement of the Alaska State Museum.
That's the difficulty with artifacts coming back. It then becomes, you know, that's a really good thing, but it's a challenge to find safe storage spaces for the artifacts that are being returned. But even though this is in a museum now, it's owned by the clan, and they can take it out of the museum anytime they need it for traditional ceremonies.
Emmons wrote several articles, including one on Tlingit weaving that is still consulted by artists. After Emmons died in 1945, his notes and drawings were compiled into a monograph, which remains one of the most comprehensive volumes on Tlingit culture today. Emmons's interest in the Tlingit culture also had a profound role in shaping the political boundaries of Southeast Alaska, for it was Emmons who single-handedly convinced President Teddy Roosevelt to set aside 5 Southeast Alaska islands as the nation's largest forest reserve. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
And you're listening to Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka.